Hello, I'm Lucy, and welcome to Micropod, your small but perfectly formed podcast on microbiology. And we'll begin with a question.
Did you hear the one about two bacteria lying on a train line?
No. Well, you may wish you hadn't when we supply the punchline a little later on. The joke was supplied at the Society for Applied Microbiology's recent spring meeting in Stratford-upon-Avon. This year's lively event was tailored to biomedical scientists and supported by the Institute of Biomedical Science to celebrate their centenary year. And even by lunchtime, it was clear that one speaker had made a huge impression.
The highlight so far has been Professor Anne Glover's talk. It was very interesting the way that her work has progressed in a very sort of organic way over her career, and it was nice to see something that wasn't as planned as we're all told to do.
The highlight for me was listening to Anne Glover. It's the first time I've actually heard her speak, and I found that really quite inspirational, especially the transition from a biochemist to microbiology and now sort of the use of nematode worms in disease models. I think it's brilliant.
Anne Glover's talk's been the highlight for me so far. I was particularly interested in a talk about biofluorescence and how she explained how she first discovered it for a friend on the beach when he emerged from it and saw her glowing and thought, I need to find out more about this. It was pretty good.
Professor Anne Glover holds a chair in molecular and cell biology at the University of Aberdeen. After working as Chief Scientific Advisor for the Scottish Government for 4 years, she was recently appointed the first ever Chief Scientific Advisor to the President of the European Commission. Anne presented the Procter & Gamble Applied Healthcare Microbiology Award lecture about her work using bioluminescence to investigate neurodegenerative disease. Afterwards, I managed to get a one-on-one interview with Anne, where we discussed her new role as Europe's top science advisor, how to influence policy, and where her scientific career began.
As a child, I was very curious, and I have this thought in my mind that everybody's born a scientist. It's just that some people get it knocked out of them as they grow up. But we're normally all very curious about our environment and how things work. And so it was obvious to me that I would go to university and study science. And when I was studying science, in contrast to what many people do now, I think, I didn't think of a job or of what it was I was going to do. I was just really, really interested in what I was doing. And so just wanted to always find out more or, you know, investigate or get involved in research. So it seemed very natural to me. It didn't take much thinking to think about doing a PhD. And then from that, the obvious thing to do is a postdoc if you're still interested in research. And it was almost by default, you know, there were no big decisions. There weren't like heart-rending moments where you said, will I do this and will I do that? It just seemed very obvious to me what I wanted to do. All I did know is I just wanted to continue pursuing research. And I loved talking about it. So the teaching aspect of a university was then very rewarding so that you could get other people enthused about what you did. But then I suppose at some point I got involved in how science strategy is set in the UK, particularly with my work with the Natural Environment Research Council, where I was on some of their peer review bodies for research awards and then on their governing council. And I enjoyed the fact that you could make a difference at the highest level in government in terms of persuading people to spend more money on particular areas of science. And so when the first Chief Scientific Advisor job came up in Scotland, and that was in 2006, it was actually a colleague of mine, another microbiologist, suggested to me, that would be something surely you would be interested in, because I hadn't seen it. And I thought, yeah, I would be interested, and applied, and the rest is history. So at the beginning of this year, I took up the post of first Chief Scientific Advisor for the President of the European Commission. That's very different than the Scottish job, I'd have to say, because Europe is a huge and complicated beast. But there's enormous potential there, you know, because Europe is and should be widely acknowledged as groundbreaking in terms of knowledge production, understanding of our environment. But it needs a voice. It needs more of a voice to talk about that.
So is that one of your aims and objectives then, to create that voice?
Yeah, the president himself is very interested in science. He's a lawyer by background. He's not a scientist, but he's clearly keenly interested and takes a personal interest in science and will read things. But he wants to be informed about what's happening in Europe, what the big issues are, where the opportunities are, and so on. So I will do that. But I am disappointed that in Europe we're so modest. Well, yes, we're the best in the world at microelectronics, but let's not talk about it. Actually, I think we should talk about it, partly because we want the best in the world to come and work in Europe, whether it's in the UK or whether it's in Germany or the Netherlands or Estonia or whatever. We want the best here. And we also want to be attracting business and have their R&D arms there, more opportunities for our scientists. And actually, the investment market, we want people who will invest in the best, the brightest, most imaginative new ideas to be investing in Europe. And that won't happen if we're very quiet about our achievement. And the biggest opportunity for us in Europe as a whole is to convert the brilliant knowledge into a difference for society, environment, economy, health, all of these different issues. It's transforming knowledge into impact, if you like, for all of these areas. And that's a tricky one to do. Will I do it in 3 years? Probably not. But will I make a start? Yes, most definitely.
What do you think will present the greatest challenges?
Actually, thinking about science will be the greatest challenge, because anybody who's listening, if they think anything they've heard about Europe, it will probably be to do with financial crisis or some irritating legislation that people have got very cross about, or some misunderstanding about what Europe's trying to do. There'll be something like that. It's not about enabling technology. It's not about being proud of being part of a grouping of countries which is the best in the world. And I think that's going to be the biggest challenge, is to start getting people to talk about, is it not amazing what European Commission funding has allowed us to do in Europe, that we have best facilities for something, or that we have broken through some new knowledge barrier. For example, I would very much hope that in the autumn we'll be hearing from the Large Hadron Collider at CERN some news about whether or not there is a Higgs boson. And actually, it's the glory of science, isn't it, that it doesn't matter whether there is a Higgs boson or there isn't. Either way, it's very interesting. Personally, because Peter Higgs has spent all his research career in Edinburgh University in Scotland, I'm very keen that there is a Higgs boson and would love to see him recognised. Lots of other things are happening in Europe. And I think that not just the people of Europe need to start realising that and thinking, look, this isn't not a risk for us. This is our future. This is a real opportunity, and taking advantage of it and being thirsty for finding out more. European politicians, they need to be thinking not just about the interests of their own member state or whatever. They need to be thinking, actually, this would be hard for us to do as a member state, but we can partner and we can make our contribution. So the biggest challenge to get people to start talking about science as mainstream activity, as part of European culture.
That leads on very nicely, actually, to my next question. Do you think that we actually need a change of culture in Europe so that science is included? It's not seen as something separate.
Takes two to tango on that one. I think that we do need a change in culture so that science should be regarded not as a risk but as an opportunity, and it should be regarded as enabling. Scientists should be regarded as people who are interesting to work with and talk to. But that's where it takes two to tango, because the scientists then need to come out of their shell. As a scientist, it's very easy for me to speak to another scientist of my own discipline, or even as another discipline, because I understand the scientific method, I understand much of the terminology and so on. What we are lazy at, scientists generally, I'm including myself, is that when we talk about our own research or we talk about science, we assume a lot of background knowledge, and we assume that we don't have to describe to people. If I'm talking about nanotechnology, I might talk about all the advantages, but they might be thinking, yeah, but surely this could be a terrible risk to have these small particles. So I need to talk about that as well. But in talking about risk, maybe I need to talk about risk and reward. Maybe I need to help them with the concept of risk, because I find it difficult sometimes to compare two risks and think, which is the riskier of those two? And it's quite difficult. And if it's difficult for us as scientists, why do we magically assume that citizens should just be able to get on with that and understand that we scientists are speaking the truth and accept what we say? We need to spend a good deal more time engaging with people of all ages. Young people are a good target, because certainly for Europe to be successful in the future, we need the smartest young people to be considering a career in science, engineering and technology. We need teenagers, we need kind of middle-aged people, we need older people, all to be actively engaged in the thinking and excitement about new discoveries in science. Almost the way they would, you know, there's a new film at the cinema, there's a new book has come out, there's a new record released by your favourite artist. Well, science should be in there along with that. But that doesn't happen in 1 month or 6 months. It takes a long time.
The involvement of scientists and the inclusion of scientific material seems to be on the increase, along with things like the Skeptics in the Pub movement, I guess you're well aware of. Do you think that the situation is changing? I've certainly, since leaving the bench myself, have noticed certainly an increase in the number of activities which have in the past, I guess, been considered cultural activities, like stand-up comedy, for example, or theatre.
There's also things like Café Scientifique, which has been going a long time, and actually I'd encourage anybody, wherever they are, get on the web, check it up and see if there's one near you. Why I like them, and I've taken part in a lot of them, is that you go along and it's often a café or a pub. You can get yourself a drink, sit yourself down. The scientist talker is very strictly instructed that no slides, no PowerPoint presentations, not death by PowerPoint. But what you have to do is just engage your audience for 20 minutes. And the questions are always really lively. It's very rewarding for everyone involved because you as the scientist understand what people are thinking about what you do or the topic you're talking about. But I would agree, you know, if you were suggesting, is there a difference? Are we seeing a greater appetite? Yeah, I do think we are seeing a greater appetite. And that is because there's more science communication. But actually, we're also now seeing stand-up comics. I know in London you can go along and get your slot where you use your science as the topic. For me personally, that would be a step too far. I think I'd find that absolutely terrifying. But I like the idea of it.
So moving back a bit more towards your new role as Chief Scientific Advisor, in terms of the development of policy, where there are issues which have a huge evidence base and are also incredibly political. What's the best way of dealing with issues like that in terms of creating policy?
I think what the policymakers and ultimately the politicians who make decisions on this, what they do need to have is a very credible, well-argued evidence base. So that's the first thing. And actually in Europe, we're pretty lucky. I mean, individual member states have their own scientific establishments, but in Europe we have something called the Joint Research Centre, where we've got over 2,000 scientists employed directly by the Commission, but working quite independently on areas such as nuclear safety, maritime affairs, nanobiomedicine, a whole variety of different areas, emissions, climate change, I could go on. But they will produce evidence about key issues. They, because they are excellent scientists, they have their networks globally, and so they can pull in a lot of added value for the Commission. And so there can be a whole menu, if you like, of evidence to underpin policy. It's what happens to it after that point. And as you quite rightly said, there's a lot of political consideration in the use of evidence. So if you take something that's happening in the UK and happened earlier on in Scotland, discussion about minimum pricing for alcohol, there's a lot of evidence which would persuade us that it would be a good idea to implement a minimum price because it targets a certain vulnerable proportion of the alcohol buying public. And although people somehow intuitively feel that, oh, it wouldn't make any difference if it was just a certain bit more, we know from the evidence that it does. People buy less. And if people buy less, there are less problems associated with alcohol. So that seems very clear. There's lots of other interests involved. There's obviously the drinks industry and the alcohol industry. And so now it gets very complicated because these employ a lot of people. And, you know, there's all these other rather muddy issues. So I think to be realistic as a scientist, such as I am involved in the evidence for policy, you can't be a purist and just say you must look at the evidence, ignore everything else and implement according to the evidence, because life isn't that simple. I think where I would be very, very definite is that if you choose to ignore evidence or to modify it, I think policymakers and politicians have to be absolutely transparent about why they do that. Because if they're not transparent and they say, for example, around genetically modified foods, we're adopting the precautionary approach. The precautionary approach suggests that you don't have enough evidence. And that is not the case with GM foods. The current state of play, because we've done so much investigation, is that there is no more risk associated with eating genetically modified foods than with eating conventionally farmed foods. So if that's the case, you can't then say, so we're adopting the precautionary approach, because that implies that we're somehow unhappy with the evidence that we got. It's not of high quality. It's cost us a lot of money to get that evidence. It's highly peer-reviewed. It's extraordinarily high quality. We can't ignore it. So what we should say is, we have the evidence, we accept that, but for other reasons, and these are the other reasons, we're taking a different course.
And do you think that scientific organisations and scientists themselves can help in ensuring that policy, which needs to be, is evidence-based?
I do think so. The biggest way that scientists can help is to try and describe uncertainty, because I think that that's where people have the most difficulty. So given that that's the case, we as scientists are very comfortable with the idea of uncertainty, but the public are not, and actually politicians are not. We need to give comparative examples. We need to give a very clear description of what we mean by uncertainty.
Will you still be able to keep your hands on in the lab now that you're chief scientific advisor for the EC?
That's going to be very difficult. The job in Europe is full-time, but I have negotiated with the Commission that I can have an honorary position still at my university, and my university have given me a laboratory, and I still have people in the laboratory, and so we are able to still continue. I think if I had to put a figure on it, maybe once a month I might be able to be there. There is, of course, email, there are telephones, there's Skype, there's lots of ways you can communicate. So I would expect that I would be able to one day a month work in the lab, and that we would still keep pushing the research forward. And it's very important to me because I'm a scientist and I still want to know stuff, and there's a lot of really interesting stuff to find out. But also, as my credibility, I think, is helped by it, because if I'm talking to people about the importance of getting funding or whatever, and they think, yes, well, you don't know because you're not involved. Well, actually, I am involved, and I do know how difficult it is, and I know what the drivers are for researchers, because I still am one.
So finally, then, what advice would you give anyone who would wish to follow in your footsteps?
I've not been one of these people that sat down with a little matrix and planned out my life. I'm just not like that. What you need to do is look at the CV of someone doing the thing that you're interested in, and then identify, well, what experience have they got? What have they done that has put them in the running, at least to be considered for whatever is being discussed? If you want to do something, just ask. What's the worst that can happen if you say, oh, I would like to come and give a talk at that major conference because we've got some really exciting research results? They could turn around and say, well, no, we're not interested in your research, but they could. And 9 times out of 10, they will say, this is really helpful, actually, because someone has offered. We don't have to go out and search. And it looks really interesting because it's just pre-publication or whatever. So just doing that, just pushing yourself forward. So I would say, don't wait to be asked. It's up to you. Nobody else is going to make your life for you. You have to decide what you want and then ask. People will be amazed how often the answer is yes.
Professor Anne Glover there at the Society for Applied Microbiology Spring Meeting. Lectures covered Group A streptococci, influenza and brucella, as well as sessions on virology and sepsis and implants. Not to mention a great lunch and some excellent chocolate cake. Well, that's it for this edition of Micropod. Oh, yes, I promised you a joke.
Did you hear the one about two bacteria lying on a train line? One looked at the other and said, oh my God, looks like we're a gonorrhea. Gonorrhea!
Told you might regret it. I'm Lucy, and I'll see you again soon.